Arizona's economy has seemed to reach a steady level as more people are working and the state's coffers are filling up again. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll look at what impact the national real estate numbers could have on Arizona. Sales of existing homes in the U.S. had their biggest drop in 5 years last month. I'll talk with Valley Realtor John Wake about what the figures mean and what he expects from the Valley's housing market in early 2016. Plus, Linda Valdez has been an editorial writer for the Arizona Republic for a number of years. In her new book, Crossing the Line, Valdez makes the issue of illegal immigration extremely personal as she tells the story of how her husband came to the U.S. illegally to be with her more than 25 years ago. We'll talk with Valdez. Also, 2016 is an election year, so it's bound to bring a lot of news to Arizona. We'll look ahead to next year and look back to 2015 with commentators Chip Scutari and Doug McCackern. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, 2016 is an election year, so it's bound to bring a lot of news to Arizona. We'll look ahead to next year and look back to 2015 with commentators Chip Scutari and Doug McCackern. We'll also hear about the year in television. Plus, we'll talk with Linda Valdez, who's been an editorial writer for the Arizona Republic for a number of years. In her new book, Crossing the Line, Valdez makes the issue of illegal immigration extremely personal as she tells the story of how her husband came to the U.S. illegally to be with her more than 25 years ago. We start today's program by looking at a rough November for existing home sales in the U.S. The National Association of Realtors reported that those sales sunk 10.5% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.76 million. It was the weakest pace in 19 months. With me to talk about that and what could be next in the Valley housing market is Realtor John Wake of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com and the new RealEstateDecoded.com. John, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So how significant are these November numbers, and if they are significant, why?
I don't think they're that significant because, particularly in the Valley, we had a really strong 2015 as far as home prices go. And there were some weird changes in the paperwork system that happened in October, which could have caused some reverberations into November. So it's kind of uncertain. Just 1 month really isn't enough to say. I'd want to see it for a few months. And my overall estimate is that for next year, it's going to be pretty strong, at least for the first 6 months, as far as sales and prices increasing in Metro Phoenix.
John, if you can explain it in a way that we would understand, what is some of that weird paperwork you're talking about?
Oh, it's called TRID. So there's a whole bunch of new mortgage rules that you have to do, a whole different... That's done by the Housing and Urban Development, has these new mortgage rules and the paperwork changes. So it causes a lot of changes for mortgage lenders as well as for title companies. And everybody's kind of getting used to the new paperwork. So that may have slowed things down, where it used to take maybe 30 days from the time you got under contract to the close loan. It may be a week or two longer than that. So that would push some sales into December that normally would have closed in November.
John, earlier this month, the Fed decided to raise interest rates. Who's going to be affected by that, and will that affect the Valley housing market?
It will kind of. The Fed rate is really loosely tied to the mortgage rate. But when the Fed rate goes up, mortgage rates tend to go up. But it's really loose. Like during the boom, the Fed rate went up 4 percentage points, and the mortgage rate went up less than 1. So, but nonetheless, when that Fed rate does go up, it tends to be that the mortgage rates go up. So the general expectation is that mortgage rates are going to go up in 2016, although not too much. People are thinking that the highest I've seen was like 1 percentage point by 12 months from now. But I think it's going to have a big impact in the first 6 months of the year because a lot of people, particularly millennials who are getting into the market, are thinking, hey, if we were thinking about buying a home sooner or later, I hear mortgage rates are going to go up. Maybe we should buy sooner. So I'm thinking the first 6 months of next year could be pretty could have a bump in sales more than people are expecting.
Do you think that's something, though, that some millennials initially would be find daunting and think, well, wow, is this really going to raise what I'm paying by a tremendous amount? But then if you do a little research, maybe you find it's not going to be that big a deal.
Yeah, if it goes up a quarter point, really, it doesn't mean that much. The way it plays out in the market is you might find that, I used to be able to afford this amount of home. Now I got to get a cheaper home, and I don't like these cheaper homes, so maybe I'll just keep renting. So that would be the effect it would have. But at this point, the quarter point doesn't mean that much. But a point could add up to, some real monthly payment, the way it affects the monthly payment.
Now, you and I have talked about Valley Real Estate many times before. At the height of the recession, post-recession, do you think we're at kind of a normal state right now? And if so, what does that mean for the fourth quarter? And what does that mean for the first quarter of next year? Does normal mean a nice, healthy market? Does it mean we need to ramp it up a little bit?
No, actually, a year ago at this time, generally the consensus was that 2015 was going to be a normal year as far as appreciation goes. Normal appreciation would be like 3 or 4%. It turns out appreciation in Metro Phoenix was 6% on a cost per square foot basis. And I don't know anybody who was predicting it would be that strong. I mean, that's good for homeowners, not so good for the millennial first-time buyers. So for the millennials, it just is, I think if they're going to get, prices aren't crazy. I mean, if you look at them on an inflation-adjusted basis, they're in the range. They're not bargains like homes were 2, 3, 4 years ago, but they're not high price. They're kind of in the range. So if I was thinking of buying sooner or later, I would agree to do it sooner because rates may go up. The economy in Metro Phoenix is doing fine. So that's kind of what if I was advising them, that's like, if you're thinking of buying next year, do it early part of the year if you can. It also depends on, you know, when your lease is up, and there's all sorts of other considerations to go into when you buy.
Are there certain Valley markets you expect to be hotter than others in early 2016? We saw for a while that even in the midst of, as we were coming out of the recession, some of the higher-priced homes were going and maybe some of the mid-priced were not. Any particular market, part of the market you're looking at more closely?
Well, actually, the luxury homes are really kind of stopped. They really slowed down because there was a lot of that stock market affects the luxury people, and the stock market was really wild in August, September, and sales really slowed down. The market that is nuts is anything under 300K. Anything under 300,000 is really selling quick. And that's kind of the mystery of this year and will determine what's going to happen next year is why aren't there more homes on the market? We're kind of wondering, there should be, at these prices, should be more homes hitting the market. And that's why prices are going up, is there's just not a big supply of homes in the market. We know one reason for that mystery is that a lot of people, this is nuts, but kind of hard to believe, there's still a lot of people in Metro Phoenix who are underwater. You bought 2005, 2006, 2007, and you didn't do a foreclosure or short sale. You're still underwater. And those people obviously don't want to sell because, let's say, to pay off your mortgage is $200,000, but your home's only worth $180,000, you're just going to stay in the house. You may want a bigger house, you may want a smaller house, whatever. You're just going to stay there because you're not going to have to pay money to sell your house. So it's as if, and that number is probably 10% of the homes in Metro Phoenix are underwater or have negative equity.
Still 10%. Wow. Okay.
Supply.
Yeah. John Wake, realtor of ArizonaRealEstateNotebook.com and RealEstateDecoded.com. He's keeping busy online. John, Happy New Year. Thanks as always.
Thanks so much, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein. Like most places across the country and around the world, Arizona has had a busy 2015. There have been Supreme Court arguments and political squabbles, along with surprises and disappointments. We're going to try to cover a few of those this morning with Chip Scutari of Scutari & Sislak and longtime journalist and former Arizona Republic editorial writer Doug McCachran. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having
us. Thank you.
All right, Chip. Now, we're going to talk education in a bit, but before we get to that specifically, because that for a lot of people who are, let's say, not Governor Doug Ducey fans in his first year, that turned a few of them, his action on education. In general, what kind of mark would you give Governor Ducey in his first year?
I'd give him a solid B+. I think he had a really good year, and I almost equate it to, I'd call it the Ducey doctrine, what we've seen when there's a big overwhelming issue or problem, such as the education funding lawsuit. He and his team will map out a vision, map out a strategy. And I give himself and his team major league kudos for wrapping up that education lawsuit. As we know, there'll be a ballot initiative on May 17th, Prop 123, which I think will pass with about 68-69%. Okay. So I give him high marks for his first year in office.
Doug, what kind of grade would you give Governor Ducey? And also, what were your expectations going in? Did you think he would be effective right away?
Well, I also give him about a B plus. I think that's a fair grade, and I do it mostly because of this. With that very complex education financing deal, he had to go out and get constituencies. He had to sell people on his vision of where education needs to head, and he did that. And that's not something that you know the history of governors in Arizona has really lent itself to in recent years. So I give him pretty good grades.
The other thing I'd chime in for those who watch the Capitol like us and for those who don't, his orchestration of getting a budget deal done in his first year in office was really impressive. I mean, he herded all the cats, you know, even though it's a Republican-dominated legislature, as we know, the Republicans of different stripes are down there from pro-business moderate to more conservative, and he got that done in a really short amount of time.
I will say, though, that I think his first political act coming into office was to engage in a fistfight with the newly elected education superintendent. And politically, I think that really left some marks on him. I think that she had a constituency that she hadn't yet offended. And
no, people were anticipating she would, but yes.
Yeah, they were. But I think that to that left some that turned some heads. It raised the notion that this is a more complex governor than perhaps you gave him credit for at the beginning.
Doug, let me stick with you, and Chip, obviously jump in, please. One of the things as a member of the media, though, that Governor Ducey's been criticized for is not necessarily being as open. We compare Governor Napolitano, like her or dislike her, she always had those public events. Governor Brewer did not do many of those where she was open to talking to the press. Do you think that's important as far as the public is concerned, or is that something that we media folks worry about?
Ducey himself, I think, hasn't really been engaged with the press. That's true. On the other hand, I think that his predecessor was pretty notorious for keeping secrets of her administration pretty tight, and so it's half a dozen of one and six of the other, I think.
Yeah, back in the days of the horse and buggy when I was covering the Capitol, Governor Napolitano really spoiled us with access. She did a weekly press briefing where you could pretty much ask anything. So those days are gone. Like Doug mentioned, Governor Brewer really, wasn't too accessible. I hear from my friends who cover the Capitol that Governor Ducey is a little more accessible. But what they're really good at is what we call in communications coaching is message discipline. I mean, they know what their talking points are. They know what they believe in, and they go out and get it.
Now, Chip, before we go to break, sure. And Doug, please chime in on this as well. Since Doug mentioned Diane Douglas, I think there were a lot of people who, going in, let's say we're going to give Diane Douglas a D or an F even before they knew what she would do. What kind of grade would you give her so far?
I didn't expect much, so I'd probably give her a solid D-. But
you weren't expecting that, right?
But I think, that's such a side issue for me as a father of three kids. She really doesn't have a big impact on the classroom, and the governor and the legislature has a lot more of an impact. So I really don't worry about her shenanigans, to tell you the truth.
She represents a constituency that I don't think are a lot of listeners of KJS. But I would say that she has failed to them as well. I think that she's more combative than has been good for her.
More looking back at 2015, looking ahead to 2016, coming up on Here and Now with Doug McCachern and Chip Scutari. And later this hour, we'll hear the very personal illegal immigration story of Linda Valdez. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Cityscape, announcing the Cityscape Downtown Ice Rink, open midday and evenings now through January 11th. Hourly light shows, tickets, and more at phxicerink.com.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Be with us today at 1 for BBC News Hour. Around the state right now, sunny skies, 62 degrees in Tucson. It's cloudy and 61 in Casa Grande. Sunshine and 68 in Yuma, 47 degrees in Prescott. Rain and snow being reported in Flagstaff, where it's 34 degrees. As you make contributions to the organizations that are important to you before the end of the year, please consider KJZZ. Listener support is at the heart of KJZZ, and your year-end gift will help pay for the new stories you counted on this year and will count on next year. Make your tax-deductible gift online at kjzz.org, and we thank you. Cloudy skies right now over Phoenix, 59 degrees at 11:21.
Good morning. It's KJZZ's Here and Now in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlak, and former Arizona Republic editorial writer Doug McCachern. We're looking back at 2015 in Arizona, looking ahead to 2016. Doug, certainly you're going to get a crack at this, but I'm going to go with Chip first. Chip, how do we define dark money at this point? Is it as powerful as some people say it is? Corporation Commission, obviously a lot of controversy over that.
You know, it's beauty's in the eye of the beholder. If you have the money, you like it. I've been actually surprised why the Democrats locally and nationally, but more so locally, haven't embraced the dark money, you know, which some would call just, you know, free speech. So an anonymous free speech. I think that, you know, they're trying to get a Terry Goddard. There's some rumors about him trying to get a ballot initiative on to reform dark money. But I really think it depends which group you're talking to, if they like or dislike dark money, but it'll continue to be in the news throughout the year with the Corporation Commission.
Yeah, I'm hearing that there will be a big push to get something on the ballot regarding dark money. I personally think that there's a premium to be paid for having a campaign that is based on dark money. I think that you'll see evidence of that in a few years when those two corporation commissioners come up for election again. And I think that they will pay a price for having been so tightly aligned with APS's dark money.
One other quick thing. I think when you get outside the political bubble, most folks who are raising families and working hard, they don't pay attention to dark money. They don't know what it is.
Do they think about the overall cost, though? I mean, even whether it's dark or not, do they look at campaigns and think, wow, they're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on that campaign? Really?
They may, but it's not. There's other bigger issues, education, you know, pocketbook issues. They're not focused on this issue of dark money where we as political pundits or political reporters love talking about it.
What about, though, as it affects electric rates or not? Because the Corporation Commission is sort of where did APS, what did APS know, how involved was APS? Doug, ultimately, does it matter if we ever find out if APS actually did it, or is perception enough?
I think it's important enough that we ultimately find out. I have a suspicion we will. But I think it's all about perception now. The interesting thing I find is that their nemesis in this entire skullduggery, SolarCity, it was the dark money provider for that so-called watchdog group in Washington, D.C. And for, that hasn't really, you know, caught fire like the APS connection to dark money has. But then again, APS is a bigger
And there's different levels of dark money. When you talk about a local city council campaign where there's an independent expenditure committee that's paid for by the local chamber, I think everyone gets tossed into, you know, dark money and, mm-hmm. you know, putting the air quotes now as I do it. No one can see me except you guys. But it's different levels where most of the time you know where chambers are investing in a state ledge race or things like that. And then there's the APS issue. How involved are they with the corp commerce? So there's different levels of anonymous free speech.
And regardless of how all this turned out, and it turns out that, you know, people sort of the dark money groups as far as APS and Corporation Commission are concerned, but I have to give a former colleague of ours here at KJZZ who got started on looking into the Susan Bitter Smith thing, and now she has resigned. Chip, is that, first of all, was that significant enough for her to resign, do you think, this conflict of interest? And if it was, why didn't anybody call this out 3 years ago?
Yeah.
I mean, she's been in office before. Why did it become something so much later?
Yeah. I mean, I've known Susan for years. She didn't make a secret of her jobs and what she did. So when the lawyer Tom Ryan called her out on it, it wasn't a secret. I'm fascinated. I don't think this is done. I'm fascinated to see how the Arizona Supreme Court will rule on this case, not on Ms. Bittersmith's case. But, you know, if you read Mark Brnovich's, our attorney general's brief, it almost calls for an expansion of regulation, which here in Arizona, Republicans, business people do not like. So it'll be really interesting to see how the Supreme Court tackles that decision, if they agree with kicking her out of office. But there could be some iterations down the road that people aren't talking about right mm-hmm. now.
Yeah, Doug.
It was Attorney General Brnovich's pursuit of her that sealed her fate. Okay. It wasn't necessarily the issue itself. It was the prospect of running for office at the same time being pursued on a legal issue like that.
How valid do you think it was, though? Because I'm going to play the devil's advocate on this and say that for a lot of people, this was sort of politics as usual. They weren't stunned by it. And, well, if she wasn't hiding it, then why didn't voters say, I'm kind of curious about this? I know voters are busy with other stuff, but it seems like once she's in, and if there's no evidence that she's done anything since she's been in office.
It was not hard to find a reference to her other outside occupations on the website of the Corporation Commission and on her personal website. It was fairly easy to find if you went looking for it. So, had it not been for, this conflict with between Solar and APS, I don't think any of this really would have ever come to the front.
Well, I just one more example, and I won't beat a dead horse here, but I'm struck by there's a major board here, county board, that for a long time they had the same members for 10 to 12 years, and many of those people were involved in the real estate business, and yet they were also passing out zoning things, and it almost seemed like an obvious conflict of interest to me. That was a board that no one really cared about, and until now, no one really cared about the Corporation Commission either.
Yeah.
Do you think we're going to get more attention now, Chip, and is that a good thing?
I think there will be definitely more attention on the Corporation Commission. There has been for the last 3 or 4 years. Governor Ducey has to make an appointment now to fill Susan Bittersmith's spot. The last time this happened, when Governor Janet Napolitano picked Chris Mays, it was a sleepy kind of board, a regulatory board. Most Arizonans had no idea what the ACC did. Now it's been in the news. It's been part of dark money campaigns. Governor Ducey's pick will be very interesting. I know Bob Robb of the Republic, his advice was appoint a placeholder. I do not think he'll do that. I think it'll be someone who'll want to stay on the CorpCom for a long time.
And briefly, guys, Doug, any names that interest you? Any names you're hearing?
Actually, no. That's one bad thing about being on the outside of the newsroom suddenly.
There have been a lot of all the names that you've heard will not get it. I've heard it's going to – just trust me on this. I think it will be someone who's in public office now but that no one's really thinking about.
Anyone attached to the Ducey administration currently?
I don't believe so. I don't think – there's been rumors about Scottsdale Mayor Jim Lane. I think he's happy being Scottsdale mayor. Okay. There have been rumors about Al Melvin, former state senator. I don't think he'll get it. But I think the appointment will come down in the next 2 weeks or so.
So when Governor Napolitano appointed Chris Mays at the time, we're not going to see Daniel Scarpinato on the Corporation Commission.
No, I don't think so.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with Chip Scutari and Doug McCachern. I want to, before I have you guys look ahead to 2016, let's talk sports briefly here. I spent most of my life here, grew up as a huge Phoenix Suns fan. They were the only pro team in town. Seems like the Cardinals, Doug, have surpassed them. Are you surprised? Is it the third straight year the Cardinals have sort of dominated the sports scene? What if the Cardinals make the Super Bowl in 2016? How big a deal would that be here?
I was beginning to think it was just me. I was a huge fan of the Suns forever, and suddenly, in my mind, they were suddenly an afterthought. So I haven't actually changed so much. Everyone else is sort of in the same boat. The Cardinals are huge. The Cardinals have all the glitter now. They have prospects to go where no Cardinal team has gone before, and that's big in this state.
I'll give you one anecdote how big the Cardinals have become, which is hard to believe, but Bruce Arians, their coach, that beret he wears or whatever the cap is called.
Kangle, I think.
Kangle.
Yeah.
I think there's a waiting list to get those types of caps at the stadium. A friend of mine tried to get one recently, and they didn't have it in the blue color that Bruce Arians likes to wear. That shows you how big their impact on pop culture in Arizona has gotten.
Well, speaking for the trio in the studio right now, we could always use hats to cover up what
is
missing on top.
Yes.
So, all right, let's look ahead to 2016. First of all, with politics, guys. Before I get down to some, if you want to make a prediction or whatnot, do you see anything changing with Arizona's congressional delegation, Chip? Any reason to think that, other than the open seat in District 1 with Ann Kirkpatrick challenging John McCain, any reason to think we're going to see any upsets, any changes there?
I do not. I think that Senator McCain will win in a shoo-in. I do not think Congressman David Schweiker will challenge him. And I think most of the incumbents will all win pretty easily. Down in Tucson, it's always tough for the Republican, but I think Martha McSally is is a rising star in Arizona politics, so I think she'll win quite handily. Mm-hmm. So I don't see any surprises there.
Doug, any thoughts there?
I would have thought, you know, I agree. I don't think that there are going to be any changes. I would have thought that because of the nature of McSally's district that there was you would see somebody rising up that would likely challenge her, and I don't see that.
Any reason to think, I mean, there's some backlash from more liberal groups against Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema, and that seems like a pretty safe district at this point now that she has won re-election and whatnot, and she seems like she's set, but is she sort of scoping out her future plans there, seemingly voting a little bit more with Republicans than some Democrats are comfortable with?
Well, by her reaction to Kirkpatrick deciding to run against McCain, you could tell that there was something on her mind. But certainly she's in the swing district. Her constituency really does not like a lot of her votes, really objects to that, but that's the nature of her district, and I think she's just positioning herself to stay there.
Well, of course, she's making the political calculus that she's going to run against Senator Jeff Flake in 2018. I think that'll be a battle royale if she decides to do it. But obviously, these votes are geared toward that to help her mainstream moderate appeal.
Now, guys, no formal predictions needed, but in the last couple of minutes, I want to give you guys a chance. Doug, what are you watching for in 2016 in Arizona? Anything that really stands out to you? A couple of things?
Well, I would like to see some sort of denouement of the Veterans Administration issue. I would like to see some sort of reform that really spoke to vets and said, you know, we've heard the complaints and we're going to reform at least on the Phoenix at the Phoenix Hospital. I would like to see something like that. It is gravely disappointing not to see anything. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to be looking at one issue. It's not super sexy, but I think transportation trends, and I'll give you two examples. One is, I think, infrastructure investment, including transportation. I think the business community and policymakers realize we don't have some of these other financing tools that other states have, like a TIF, a tax increment financing. And as an anecdote, when Intel built their latest fab plant, they spent tens of millions of dollars on water, sewer lines, roads, and they just don't want to do that again. Other corporations don't want to do that again. So I think we'll see a look at other financing mechanisms for infrastructure. And then on the transit side, you know, rumblings that former Mesa Mayor Scott Smith will take over on the interim basis to be Valley Metro CEO, which he's done in the private sector when he was head of Kay Hovannion when he took it over. So he's a turnaround agent. I think then we'll see light rail build out, you know, the transforming of downtown Phoenix, Mesa, and Tempe.
I think that could be a good way to close up.
Sure.
Doug, what do you think of the controversy over Steve Banta? And, you know, is that going to have any impact going forward as far as transit expanding, or is this considered to be sort of a one-off?
I don't think it's a real reflection on the department itself. I think it was a disturbing story about an executive going awry, wildly awry. But I don't think in the long term, anyway, it's going to have any impact on that. I would like to see, if I've got time,
please,
I would just say that I would like to see some sort of reform of the state's Groundwater Act.
Celebrate 35 years, Doug. Come on.
Yes. It's time. There are lots of very important reforms that are necessary. And I don't know if the legislature is up for it, but it'd be nice if they were.
Quick final thoughts.
Quick prediction. I'm hearing that Senate President Andy Biggs wants to wrap up the legislative session, sine die, by St. Patrick's Day.
I thought you were going to say by January 25th.
But they're already working on the framework of a budget deal, so I look for a short legislative session this year.
Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sislak, former Arizona Republic editorial writer Doug McCachran. Guys, thanks for coming in. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Happy
Merry
New
Christmas.
Year.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Arizona Senior Senator John McCain issued a statement earlier this week criticizing President Obama for refusing to posthumously pardon legendary boxer Jack Johnson. McCain and Nevada Senator Harry Reid have pushed for Johnson's pardon a number of times over the years. To learn more about Jack Johnson and the effort to pardon him, I'm joined for a few minutes by Joe Santoliquito, president of the Boxing Writers Association of America. Joe, thanks for squeezing us in.
Not a problem. My pleasure.
So how important a figure was Jack Johnson in the history of boxing actually in the ring?
He was an incredibly important figure. He defied, I like to say he's the father of the modern day athlete. He spoke his mind. He said what was, he was an unfiltered athlete, an unfiltered African-American during a time when black men and white men, you know, weren't allowed to walk on the same sidewalks together. He went against, at those times, what were the tenets of the times. And basically, he was his own man, and it made him special. And the laws against, the laws that he broke were trumped up laws.
And tell some of our listeners who don't know, Joe, what were some of those laws that he is was convicted of breaking?
He had a white mistress that he took over state lines, things of that nature. I mean, stuff that we would basically laugh about today. But laws intended to basically go after someone like Jack Johnson, an African American man who had white girlfriends and had white mistresses. He was married to a white woman. Actually, I believe a couple of white women. And, you know, again, during those times, it was obviously very frowned upon. And they created, it's just trumped up laws that really, I can't wrap my mind around it because, again, I mean, we're here in 2015. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the early turn of the century and in the 1900s, we're still getting out of a Victorian era at that period of time when, again, if you weren't white, you know, you had to live a certain way. You had certain restrictions placed on you.
Now, Joe, does it surprise you that Senators McCain and Reid keep bringing this up? I mean, is there a reason to think they're going to somehow get this pardon passed by some future president?
I like them too. I like to believe it. I was there. I was there in 2010 in Reno when they had the 100th anniversary of the Jack Johnson fight against Jim Jeffries, which at the time was the first fight of the century. And Senator Reid was there. President Obama was kind of was very noncommittal, I suppose is the best way to word it.
Okay.
And it's a shame because he's placed in a spot where here, first African-American president in the history of the country, and then you have, you know, the first African-American that was ever heavyweight champion of the world, who really, again, really didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
Did something wrong for for those times. But we're not talking about anything terribly great. He didn't kill anyone.
Right.
He didn't turn around and now he did have a history. He did have a history of I'll just say some domestic abuse. There was there was some a little bit of history there, here and there.
Right.
But in terms of he was never locked up for anything like that.
Yeah, Joe,
was locked up for.
Joe, let me jump in because I've only got about 30 seconds left. But I want to say, based on what you're seeing and what you know of the history of this, is there reason to be optimistic that at some point Jack Johnson will get this pardon in our lifetimes?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, I believe so. I believe there will be a president in the future that will look at his body of work. And the man certainly deserves it. He was one of the all-time greats, very special athlete.
Joe Santoliquito is president of the Boxing Writers Association of America. We've been talking for just a few minutes about Jack Johnson and the efforts to posthumously pardon him. Joe, thank you. Happy New Year.
You too. Bye-bye.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear the very personal illegal immigration story of writer Linda Valdez. Stay with us on Here and Now.
KJZZ is supported by Chandler Center for the Arts presenting Zope, a one-ring Old World Italian family circus December 22nd through January 3rd, featuring acrobatic and equestrian feats plus canine capers. Tickets at chandlercenter.org.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on 91.5 and online at kjzz.org. We're looking for a mostly cloudy day today in the Phoenix area, high near 62 degrees. About the same for tomorrow. We've got a slight chance for rain with a high of 63, and then it's going to cool down a little bit for Christmas Day on Friday with cloudy skies and a high near 57. Here and Now from Boston starts today at 12. Virginia's Attorney General is taking a major gun control step by refusing to recognize out-of-state handgun permits from 25 other states. That's one of the stories coming up at noon on KJZZ. Cloudy skies right now in the valley. Reports of light rain falling in the West Valley at this hour, and it's 59 degrees at 11:41.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The immigration system in the U.S. is by most accounts broken. An estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants are in the country. Did they come in illegally because it was the quickest way? Did they try to do it legally but were stymied by an out-of-date system? It's an extremely emotional issue, even for those who haven't been directly affected by it. In her new book, Crossing the Line, author Linda Valdez makes the system as personal as possible as she talks about meeting her husband in Mexico and the ways they tried to get him to Arizona legally before trying another option. And Linda Valdez joins me now from Tucson. Linda, let me start off with your first experiences with Mexico. You moved to Arizona from Ohio with your mom for health reasons. You were just a girl when you first went to Mexico. What did it feel like to you the first time you went there?
My first experience with Mexico was going to the border town of Nogales and the curio shops, and it was pretty overwhelming. It was something completely different than anything I had ever experienced in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I grew up, in the outskirts of Cleveland, Ohio. There were all these shops and all these people trying to lure you inside. There was a experience when we first drove across the border with little kids running up and asking my father, "Can I watch your car? Can I watch your car?" And him giving them money to do so, and me later finding out from my mom that they weren't really watching the car. My father was giving them money in, so that they wouldn't do something to the car. I mean, it was an exposure to a kind of poverty that I had never seen before or really understood at all. There were all these juxtapositions with the bright, sparkling things in the curio shops and then the very poor children out there selling their chewing gum and trying to watch the cars of tourists. So I liked it from the sense of the excitement. I liked going to the border town, but I never really knew Mexico for many, many years beyond just that border town experience.
At that point, even as a girl, was it a place you wanted to learn more about? You described meeting your husband for the first time when you and your mother and a friend of hers, I'll call it an excursion, with a traveling group, and the way you describe it is amazing. I mean, the senses that we get, there's no air conditioning. The robbers come on the bus, and you're not sure if the bus driver was connected with them, and all this, I mean, really intricate. And then once you settle down in the one city, I was really struck by how it seemed like you were drawn to your husband right away, at least in the writing of it. And did it actually feel that way at the time? And if so, what were some of the qualities that made you fall in love with your husband? You even say, there's even a line where you say, "I was in love." You're on this trip, which has all these wild adventures to it. You describe this one point where the two of you are walking together and there are roaches everywhere. how were you able to see through all that to fall in love?
Well, that's the magical part, I guess. I mean, when I was not a person who believed in love at first sight until I met my husband. And we truly did. We just hit it off. He had been working in the hotel where we stayed and he had hurt his ankle. So he rode back on the train through Copper Canyon. And we sat next to each other and we talked and talked and talked. And this is a very odd talking because I didn't speak a lot of Spanish and he didn't speak a lot of English. But there was a connection there. He was so kind and so open and so sincere. Some of the first things that we talked about, as a matter of fact, were the Bible, because he grew up in a Mennonite tradition and he was very, very much interested in the Bible, and we discussed that, and we discussed the way things get changed in translation. And I don't know, there was just a connection from the beginning, and it was a magical time.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Linda Valdez about her new book, Crossing the Line. You may know Linda better from her work as an editorial writer for the Arizona Republic. Linda, I want to dig in deeper on the cultural differences and the language barrier that was so strong. Why did you think that some of those challenges were worth overcoming? And at what point did you know that the two of you could overcome them?
I wasn't sure that we could overcome them until he arrived here and I picked him up downtown after he had crossed the border illegally, because we worked very hard to try and get him a visa. And at one point I was ready to say, well, this is not going to happen. It's not meant to be. And I don't know. I guess you just have to think back to what it feels like when you're just absolutely madly head over heels in love, and you wake up in the middle of the night and all you can do is think about the person. And that's the way I felt about him from the beginning. And when we worked through our differences, we were just determined it was going to happen. That's all. And once he got here, then we were married 2 weeks after he arrived, and we've been together for 27 and a half years.
Did you feel like that was something he would do? I mean, I know you tried legal channels. You tried to go and do it the right way, or the way the system was set up. But did you think that, I mean, you would describe, I think it was a McDonald's, where you could see people just sort of crossing the border pretty easily. Did you get a feeling from him that being with you was important enough that he was willing to just go ahead and go through the tunnel and come on through?
Well, he did not want to cross the border illegally from the beginning. Which is why we went through a lot of efforts. I got him an affidavit of support, and he tried to get a visa to cross the border legally. It wasn't going to happen, and at that time he was staying in a church, an Assembly of God church in Nogales, where many people who had crossed the border illegally or were planning to do so were waiting either to try again or to go back home, or it was sort of a way station for people. And they sort of laughed at him because he kept trying to get his papers in order the proper way. And, you know, and then we'd meet. I'd go down there several times a week, and we'd meet and sit in the park. And then he'd come back to the church, and he'd be very unhappy. And at one point we decided, okay, well, this isn't going to happen. And then we talked about having him come through the fence, and I would drive him up. And he didn't want to do that because that created a risk for me if we were stopped. And so we were just kind of at a stalemate. And one of the people at the church where he was staying said, okay, just come with me. They walked to the fence. He walked through. My husband followed him through. And that was it. He was through the border. And he took a bus from Nogales to Tucson. And he had his passport because he had gotten the passport to go down to Hermosillo to the American consulate and try to get the visa. The Border Patrol agent got on the bus and looked at everybody's papers, looked at his passport, looked at the picture, looked at him, and handed him back the passport without ever seeing whether it had a visa on it or not, which is really fortunate because my husband does not lie. He would not have been able to lie his way out of that situation. If they'd asked him any questions, he would have told them honestly that he didn't have a visa.
As in love as the two of you were at that point, were you scared when he did that? Did you feel like, oh gosh, I wish we had tried more? Or the fact that you had tried so much at that point through the legal channels, did you feel like, well, if we're going to be together, this is how it has to be?
At that point, I felt like the system had really betrayed me because, as you know, I'm a journalist, and I had worked with the people that I had worked with people in the Border Patrol, and I had called and gotten answers to the questions of how to do this legally, and I had gone through all the proper steps, and I felt like the system had really betrayed me. It didn't work, so I was ready to do it however I had to do it.
Linda, let's look at a little bit about what immigration policy is like. It doesn't seem like anyone thinks the system is exactly working well now. Based on the knowledge that you have of the system and how it goes, and the fact that you know, there are going to be immigration policies in this country. There's going to be border security. How would you modify what has become a broken system? Because the way you describe it in the book, the way the system was a quarter century ago or so, there were holes, but there were also things were not run by coyotes or smugglers and whatnot. And that seems to have added a real dangerous layer that wasn't there before.
Right. I mean, I think we as a society have made policy decisions and changes that have really made things worse along the border. We've taken a situation where the majority of the people did not come here for the reason my husband came here. The majority of people come here for jobs, and they still do. the ones that come from Central America now are coming here fleeing violence and intimidation by gangs. But the majority of the people come here because they come for jobs. And the immigration system is completely broken. They get here. They can get the jobs. There's very little done in the matter of worksite enforcement. So what we've done in that intervening time was build the fences, make it tougher for people to come, make it more lethal for them to come. They die. They suffer bad injuries when they fall or jump off the wall. And yet, they can still find jobs once they get here. So it's a very unjust system. What we need to do is fix the system so that people who want to come here to work can do so legally. And we need to find a way to make sure that employers no longer hire people illegally, that they suffer real consequences and real penalties for that. That's the way that you secure the border and stop illegal immigration. And then we need to look at Central America and those children that are coming here now and the families and what they're fleeing, and we need to treat them like the refugees that they are. They're coming here to us for help, and we are not treating them in accord with our national ideals.
Again, because the story is so personal, and many of us sort of willy-nilly just use the term illegal immigration without really having had direct experience with it, do you ever think about what your life would be like if the love of your life had not crossed illegally?
No. No, I don't think about that. I don't. I just want to say that the reason I wrote this book is because it's a different kind of immigration story. And I think people need to realize that there's more to this than just the stereotypes. And there's certainly a lot more to Mexico than the stereotypes. What would have become of me? I don't know. I think of a wonderful life. I'd have become the old matron librarian or something. I have no idea what would have become of me. I don't even want to think about it.
We've been talking with Linda Valdez. She's the author of the new book, Crossing the Line, and she's also an editorial writer for the Arizona Republic. Linda, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. As 2015 comes to a close, we have a chance to think back about all that we've listened to and read and watched over the year. Joining me now to talk about 2015's year in television is KJZZ senior producer and resident pop culture nerd, Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
Sarah, let's start off with what you thought was great in 2015.
Well, that's a good place to start because I think we saw a really great year in TV, both in terms of new shows and the continuation of some series that are already popular. So I think the first thing that we have to mention is Empire, because this is, by many accounts, the biggest show of the year. It's in its second season. It's done extraordinarily well, and not just in ratings, but also it's really created this very rich cultural conversation. So the show is about a hip-hop music and entertainment company and its founder, who is played by Terrence Howard. And in the first episode of the series, he's diagnosed with a terminal illness, and he's trying to figure out which of his sons should take over the company. But of course, it is very, very complicated. And there's so much buzz around the show, how well it's written, how quickly the plot moves along. There's also been a lot of talk about the fact that this is a show with an almost all-black cast, and the ratings have been amazing, which means that people like this and they want to see more shows like this. There's also an openly gay character on the show. He's one of the main character's sons, and he struggles with his father's lack of acceptance of his sexuality. This is actually based on the creator Lee Daniels' relationship with his own father. And this season, there's also a sex scene featuring Gabourey Sidibe, who's a fat woman, which was a very, very talked about scene. So the show is doing a lot of interesting things, and it's poised to do really, really well next year as well.
Okay, so what else stood out for you this season?
Well, Better Call Saul, which is the prequel to Breaking Bad, came out, and it was hugely successful. In its first season, Bob Odenkirk, who plays Jimmy McGill, a.k.a. Saul Goodman, was nominated for an Emmy and a Golden Globe as lead actor, and people have really, really responded to the show. Now, I personally was really, really skeptical when it came out because I wasn't sure about the premise. When I first heard about it, I really loved Breaking Bad, and I was not sure that the plot line was going to work. However, I was so pleasantly surprised. It turned out to be a really nuanced show, which has lots of layers. There's lots to unpack. And it maintains a really similar tone to Breaking Bad in that it's a dark show, but it's also really, really funny. So I want to play a clip for you. This is when Jimmy is trying to park at the courthouse, and he's driving this, like, beat-up clunker. He's been having these altercations with the parking attendant. He's just not in a good place in life. And the parking attendant is played by Jonathan Banks.
I suggest you find parking somewhere else.
Somewhere else? As in where somewhere else?
Not my concern.
This is your job, so by definition, it's your concern. So pump out the ticket and open the stupid gate already, please. I mean, I don't have time for this. Hey, I'm gonna park right here.
I don't think you want to be doing that.
Oh, yeah? What are you going to do? You got a poop-filled diaper in there? You going to throw it at me? Are you going to gum me to death, huh, geezer?
So as you can see, like, super humorous, even in the kind of dark moments of Jimmy's life. Plus, there's something about this character that is surprisingly and wonderfully charming. It turns out that when you find out his backstory, it makes him a lot more likable. And I actually even find him relatable in some ways. So I love this show.
And, Sarah, it seems like the less conventional outlets for TV are really picking things up, especially Netflix.
Yeah, which is in many ways becoming the more or perhaps even the most conventional outlet, right? Orange is the New Black saw its third season, and this is one of those shows that people binge watch so quickly. It seems like everyone talks about it for, like, 3 weeks, and then you don't hear much about it until the next season comes out. And then two new series that premiered on Netflix this year, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and Aziz Ansari's Master of None, both very talked about and beloved comedies that have done very, very well. So here's a clip from Master of None where Aziz Ansari's character is talking to his father, who is actually played by Aziz Ansari's real-life father.
Now, how many women did you meet before you decided on mom?
Two.
Two, that's it? What was wrong with the first lady?
She's a little bit too tall. As soon as she stood up, I was like, oh, no.
So I'm really enjoying this show right now, and I'm definitely looking forward to season two of Kimmy Schmidt.
Now, Sarah, I know you like to watch reality TV without shame.
Without.
Any trends you're seeing in reality TV in 2015?
Oh, I am so glad that you asked. Yes, I've noticed a few things. The first is that the number of reality shows that, not competition shows, but just shows about a person or a family in their everyday life, I think we're probably at an all-time high for that. And a lot of people like to dismiss these types of shows. Immediately, they think about the Kardashians and they get really annoyed. But I actually think the cool thing is that right now we're seeing shows featuring lots of different people. So there's a new show on A&E called Born This Way, which is about young adults living with Down syndrome as the central characters. There's also Push Girls, which has been around for a few years. It's about women who use wheelchairs. There's Shaws of Sunset, featuring Persian Americans, several of whom are Persian Jewish. Sister Wives features an openly polygamous family. There's also Breaking Amish, about young adults looking to leave the Amish world. Thicker Than Water, about a preacher's family. And there are several shows featuring little people and their families. The list goes on and on. Now, they might not always be done in the most maybe sensitive way or the way that everyone appreciates, but we are seeing lots of different people as the stars of these shows. I also noticed that there are a few shows dedicated to watching the people who serve rich people. So a lot of them are on the Bravo network, for example, Millionaire Matchmaker and Million Dollar Listing. But there's also a show called Below Deck about the people who work on yachts, and a new one called Après Ski about people who work at a ski resort.
And you've also told me there are a lot of shows about getting married.
Yes, there are. The number of shows dedicated to either finding a spouse, getting married, planning a wedding, or the first year of marriage is astounding. Now, I am someone, generally speaking, who loves these shows, even though they often play into really conventional ideas. But I'm worried that we may have reached the oversaturation point for this. This year in particular, there is more than one show which is about people marrying strangers and the beginning of their married life together. One is called Married at First Sight, where couples trust a set of random matchmakers to pair them up and then walk down the aisle, marrying this person sight unseen. And this is in its third season. So apparently the folks participating this season feel really good about what happened in seasons one and two. And another one is called Married by Mom and Dad, in which couples allow their parents to choose their future spouse.
I'm planning a wedding, but I don't have my groom yet.
Oh, wow.
We've got like two good girls there.
You will have to rely on us to make the final call.
Excited to have the girls meet us today.
Do you have outstanding debts? Are you a shopper? What are your sexual expectations?
Kind of made me feel like I was a criminal.
So that's just a clip from the trailer, but as you can imagine, there's like no holds barred, tons of drama surrounding that, and there's a lot more. There's a lot more out there and a lot more coming in 2016.
KJZZ senior producer Sarah Ventry, also our resident TV nerd. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Another thanks to senior producer and reality TV fan Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help. And thank you very much for listening. If you want to catch my conversations with Linda Valdez or Chip Scutari and Doug McCachern, go to KJZZ.org later this afternoon or download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. NPR's Here and Now is next on KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Happy holidays and Merry Christmas, and have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by the Titan Missile Museum south of Tucson, an atomic heritage site featuring a rare look into the once top secret world of America's largest nuclear weapon. Open daily. Tickets and information at TitanMissileMuseum.org.